snap this in properly. Good evening, everyone.
Whoa.
Good evening.
My voice is a little booming there. I like the seat enforcers there. Thank you. We appreciate your assist on that. Good evening, everyone. I'm Sandra Clark. I'm the Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue here at WHYY. Thank you for joining us tonight on this rainy night. We appreciate you coming out as we look into Philadelphia's evolving landscape and the role of preservation among the change. In a city as historic and dynamic as Philadelphia, finding a balance between the new and the old is a tall order. Preservationists, developers, artists, and others here tonight grapple with this issue daily. They make decisions that shape our city and our understanding of its past. And I find it fitting to have this discussion at WHYY, which itself is set on the site of Pennsylvania Hall, a meeting place for abolitionists, which was burned to the ground days after it opened. There's a historical marker in front of the building that speaks to those events and the citizens who lived before us and made positive contributions to our nation. Without these markers and other preservation efforts, are we erasing our history from public places? Do we have a responsibility to collect, preserve, and disseminate our history? And how can we do it in a way that speaks to today's city? These are some of the questions we'll seek to answer tonight. And beyond promoting in-depth reporting on local neighborhoods, Plan Philly is equally committed to cultivating open dialogues about the challenges we face as a community. And we want to give our audience tools for informed opinions. We at WHYY and Plan Philly are honored to host and participate in this convening of our community around these issues. Off-air opportunities like this also help you to know better WHYY and Plan Philly. And before we continue, I'd like to acknowledge the WHYY members and Plan Philly supporters here with us today. I very sincerely say we thank you, and we could not do things like this without your support, so thank you very much. Give yourselves a round of applause. Let's wake up the room here. All right, if you can't clap for yourself, I don't know. You deserve all that applause. So we take your trust very seriously. And as you know, journalism is in a little distressed mode these days, very seriously under attack. But we take very seriously your trust in the work that we do. Our Plan Philly focuses on urban design and planning, transportation and development, and is constantly working to meet your needs. And I will say very sincerely that every single time we get to meet face-to-face and we have events like this, we think of things and we hear about things that we never would have thought of before. So thank you for taking the time to be here with us tonight. And with your support, we look forward to continuing to expand what we offer our community. And now we'll start this evening's discussion with a few words from Plan Philly editor Ariella Cohen. So please join me in welcoming Ariella.
Thank you, Sandy. So I sometimes have problems with microphone, the height situation. So can you guys hear me? Great. So I'm Ariella Cohen. I'm the managing editor of Plan Philly. Thank you so much for being here tonight. So we've invited you here to talk about some tricky topics. So we expect a lively debate. So thank you for joining us for the ride. First, let me introduce our incredible panel. I'm going to start with Faye Anderson. First of all, I'd just like to shout out Faye real quick because she gave a tour for us this Saturday of the Green Book sites in Philadelphia, and I learned so much, and I know everyone else on the tour did too, so it's great to be back with you, Faye. Faye is a preservation activist and the director of All That Philly Jazz, a public history project that maps Philadelphia's lost jazz clubs. She leads walking tours around the city, bringing attention to Philadelphia's Black history. Next, we have Ori Feibusch. Ori Feibusch is a developer and all over Philadelphia, but he's done a lot of work in the Point Breeze area in South Philadelphia. He's currently redeveloping the site of the historic Royal Theater, a site that we visited on Saturday with Faye. It's a Green Book site. He's redeveloping the theater while preserving the facade, thanks to an easement held by the Preservation Alliance. Is there anyone here from the Preservation Alliance in the crowd? All right. Well, thank you. Great. And now we have Paul Farber. Paul is a curator, historian, and the artistic director and co-founder of Monument Lab, a public art and history project that focuses on how monuments shape our collective memory. And then Karen Olivier. Karen Olivier is an artist and associate professor and program head of sculpture at Tyler School of Art and Architecture. She designed a memorial for Dina, a one-time enslaved African-American housekeeper at Stenton Mansion in Nicetown. And Dina saved the mansion from being burned down during the Revolutionary War. She's installed other public art projects, some of which reflect on history in New York, Houston, Philly, and Dakar. So we have a really great... We have a really great panel. And I want to start off with a question for an entire panel. I'm going to take a seat now. The important thing is that everyone has 30 seconds, and Elizabeth Estrada, our audience engagement manager, is going to be timing folks. So the question is, how do you define preservation? And we'll start with Faye.
Preservation is about saving and preserving those places that matter, those places that hold stories of culture, resistance, and resilience.
So preservation, from where I sit, is deeply personal to each individual, but it's effectively preserving or maintaining something that has real personal value for you. Is there a button? It's on. Hello?
I was simply, there we go, hi. That preservation is deeply personal to every individual, and it's not defined by a set of bricks or some historic standard, but it's something that means something personal to every individual, and often the same parcel or property might have real affinity for one person and real vitriol for another. So it's truly just a personal perspective on an individual property.
I don't know why I did not predict that question. Preservation is about the contemporary, about the now. It's about the now.
Preservation is the way that we understand... that we understand the soul of a city. It lives... it lives in buildings, it lives in monuments, but it really lives in people. And it is about the values, the vision, and the ethics of a city. It does, of course, as I say, live in brick and mortar, but it has a higher purpose that is personal, it's also shared, and cuts across time.
May I reclaim my 15 seconds?
This one time, yes.
Okay, because Paul talked about brick and mortar, but for me, vacant lots, vacant spaces hold those stories. Like when I go to Broad and Carpenter, the former location of Union Local 274, to stand in that space, if Local 274 was the Black Musicians Union, I feel their presence standing in that space.
Thank you. So I also want to set a ground rule and set one manner of housekeeping. We have a hashtag today, public memory. So we've assembled a really diverse panel intentionally. We all have different opinions here, and we want to keep a spirited but civilized debate, but we want you to share your opinions and tell us what you agree with, what you disagree with on Twitter using the hashtag public memory. So that's just an important ground rule tonight. But we've got off to a great start with those different definitions. As you can see, it's intensely personal, and we all are thinking about preservation differently. Now I want to ask a question about the city as a whole, and I want the whole panel to answer. Do we as a city have a collective responsibility to preserve sites of the past?
Yes. I mean, we're in a moment where we've gained status as a World Heritage City, and we're also going through a moment where that heritage can be bulldozed every day, where there isn't a big plan to preserve that status. It falls to the responsibility of people, of institutions that are trying to get it right. We are in a city that has new, of course, developments and condos and housing, and also in a city that has a homeless population that's tripled over the last 2 years. It's not disconnected from this story and this moment of preservation. It is about those great stories that we take immense pride in, and also those moments of struggle that define who we are as a city.
If I can add, I believe Philadelphia is the first city to have a historic preservation ordinance. So as a matter of law, we have responsibility to protect and save and preserve places that matter. And too often, places that matter were defined by the architectural significance. But for places that matter to diverse populations, and Black folks in particular, they're unadorned because these places reflect the social and economic inequality. So we're not going to expect places where Black history happened to be architecturally significant. So yes, we do have responsibility as a matter of law to protect these places.
So without question, preservation and the historic fabric of our city is a public good and something that should be cherished and fought for by everyone. What has historically happened in Philadelphia is that the entire system is so broken, so inept, that you end up with this hand-to-hand combat of developer versus neighborhood or developer versus neighbor. And it's a shame, because if we looked at our historic fabric in a collaborative way and we really sat down and analyzed, and that's why I think this panel is wonderful, because you're bringing in a developer to be a part of the conversation. But if we really looked at what was needed to preserve buildings, what was needed to preserve neighborhoods, where we were failing at maintaining our historic fabric, then we could collaboratively put together plans and actions that would ensure that what we all hold dear to ourselves, which is the public and the historic fabric of our city, could be maintained.
I think we all know and agree that it's important, and everyone, when I hear that word, everyone, but how does that get realized? To me, everyone, yes. If you're an engaged citizen in the world, if you kind of want to be a person who's about humanity and what it means for us to collectively be together and create culture, counterculture, I just wonder, when we say everyone, it's everyone is just too generic. It's too easy to absolve yourself. No, certain people have more responsibility than others because of what you did. You know what I mean? So when we say everyone, how do we break that down?
Yeah. I think that's a really important question. So I said, do we as a city, and now I'll direct this to you, Ori, do you think that developers have a civic responsibility to preserve sites?
So I don't believe that developers have the specific responsibility to preserve sites. And the question suggests that preserving a building or demolishing a building ever sits on the margin. Like, we're flipping a coin, we feel like it. We had a bad breakfast, we'll demolish the building. The numbers of preservation or for preservation are so incredibly askew that a developer needs to purchase the property with the clear understanding, the absolute awareness that that is the plan from acquisition. You know, the Royal Theater that we touched on here, we bought the building with open eyes. We knew there was a historic facade easement, and we factored into the budget the idea of preserving that facade. That was $1 million to preserve the facade. The idea that we could buy a building, realize that it was important, and then have to save it is a little bit of a fool's errand. And, you know, something like the Royal Theater or, you know, the 19th Street Baptist Church or other properties that are so obviously aware to the average passerby that they have historic fabric, it's easy to ask the question of, does a developer have a responsibility? We're certainly looking at the public discourse that's going to occur when we purchase it. But some buildings are not so obvious. I purchased a property on the corner of Huntington and Thompson in Port Richmond, where the neighborhood group, the councilman, and the state rep begged for me to buy the building and tear it down because it was a nuisance and a blight for the community. There was some type of after-hours club there. And if you looked at the building, there was nothing unique about the building for myself as a layman. It was a John Notman church. I didn't even know who John Notman was at the time, forgive me, but I believe he founded the American Institute of Architects. And it was a building that was incredibly important for many people, right? So here I am being invited into the community by a host of individuals, inclusive of every neighbor. I buy a property, and then I'm told that it should be historic, right? There was no historic nomination or even discussion of it beforehand. And then what do? Right, so either there's a pool of capital, right? All of us as taxpayers.
I think we're skipping ahead. Let's stop that now and go to this question. What do you do? And I want to flip that question to Karen and Paul. Both of you, I think, have done really interesting work around reinterpreting history and memory. And thinking about how we build the past into lived experiences. And so in one scenario that you're laying out, I think I remember the story that you're talking about with that church, and that church did end up being demolished, right? So once a historic site is demolished and a new site takes root there, how are there ways to salvage the past? Are there ways to narrate that history?
I think I'm not going to answer that. Well, I was just thinking about, I just decided to visit the MOVE bombing site. I'm working on a piece for the ICA that's a memorial. And I was amazed that across the street there was one little plaque. Yeah. And it was, and I just happened to walk by and I heard someone say something about MOVE. So, of course, I'm nosy, so I went into the conversation. But it was amazing how they spoke about, okay, after the bombing happened, people were giving out money. So it got rid of, so they kind of were dealt with, but then the city built shoddy buildings that then, like, claiming eminent domain because they were horrible. And now those same houses are being sold now, the new versions are being sold more than my house in Germantown. I mean, it's like someone's making a lot of money off of a lot of suffering and death and murder. So it's just a straight, and the thought that there's just one plaque, okay, that's commemorating, that's honoring, it's something. But how can, it felt like the audacity for that to be it. And those houses are cookie cutter, gentrified, at least do something.
And to complicate that narrative, you know, I think this is a really interesting scenario. We had a reporter write about this development when it was, when ground was broken. She spent a couple of days talking to neighbors. They all were so excited that new houses that were just regular houses were being built there, and they explicitly had petitioned the city not to have a memorial because they felt like they had lived this trauma and were done with it. And so, I mean, I think these are all
and
relevant.
That's interesting, but then I think about what happens when they're no longer here. Yeah. Like when you were saying about that vacant spot, when you're not here, like how do we hold, there is something about the concrete, you know, so, you know?
Yeah, and I think it both the channel, what Faye was talking about and conjuring that spirit in a vacant space and that historic marker across from 63rd Street that was, you know, championed by the Jubilee School, which took young people to petition for that, young people of color primarily. But it just reminds us that historic designation is not neutral. Development is not neutral. It's not ahistorical. And so when you encounter a property that there's a question whether it is worthy of saving or preserving or at least marking, the very process that brings us what is worth saving has been so skewed for such a long time. It's cut out stories of marginalized people in the city. It has for so long been a high bar to achieve this notion of what's historical. And so when you think about any one of these sites that we're talking about, what's our process? If we are prioritizing fast development and profit, we cut away from the people, right? We cut away from the history that's important. And it's, of course, there's history to celebrate. There's also history to caution us of what's going on. You know, you look around the city and some of the neighborhoods that we're talking about, experienced profound forms of redlining that fueled white flight, that fueled disinvestment, and those same neighborhoods that are coming back with predominantly white residents or more affluent residents, we see the cycle, we've seen it. And if we don't understand that that's written into the landscape, into this so-called neutral process, then we're doomed to repeat those same injustices.
Yeah, I think that it's inevitable that in a conversation like this, it does kind of get down to this very tricky, very current topic of like cultural displacement. And this is something that I think is hard to talk about. There's not really like tools. It's not something that's part of a preservation toolkit around historic federal historic tax credits or recognition because there was a particular architect or something like that. And I know that some cities like San Francisco have created some regulations. I think, for instance, they have like a local business registry where if you're a business that's been around for 30 years, you're eligible for some kind of protections or tax credits. These are questions the city has thought about trying to do other kinds of measures that would protect longstanding cultural forces. And I wonder how you as a panel think about that. You know, are there tools that you think are a good idea, bad idea? Ori, I'm interested in your perspective as well.
Sure. And to be clear, I know there's a lot of public discourse about gentrification, displacement, social changes in the neighborhood. Many of the blocks that are seeing development, the neighbors that are there, not the loud voices, but the quiet ones, want dignity restored to their block. And so they're eager for the development and they're supportive of it. I also suggest that there's been a complete dearth of any type of community-based historic designations. Most of the historic designations in our city have happened by either one of two sources, either Oscar Bizart, who's an individual who has taken the task of designating buildings that he believes are important, and that's, of course, his discretion, or the staff at the Historical Commission. And then a distant third might be the Preservation Alliance, but the community has not been asked which buildings are important to you, what memories are important to you, and that's been a complete failure of the city of Philadelphia as a whole.
And as one of those loud voices, that what is sorely lacking is an inventory that the community knows which buildings are important and their significance. I'll give you an example. The Philadelphia Housing Authority decided they were going to demolish this building at Ridge and Oxford. To them, it was just blight. But for those in the community, they knew that was the former location of, in the 30s, it was called the Checker Cafe. In the 80s, the Checker Club. One of the last remaining jazz clubs standing. And they were going to just go in. It's for those who are not familiar with the building, it's the one with the Pearl Bailey mural. And not knowing that community history, not having an inventory of places that matter. That's one of the most important things we need right now is an inventory of historic resources.
That's an amazing idea.
Can I talk about that for a moment?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, the inventory is important. The process of talking about what is historical, why it matters, and to stop the flow of a quick answer. You know, something on my mind this week is the destruction of the mural Language Lab in South Philadelphia. The artist Shira Walensky is here, and is a mural that was made with the city, Department of Behavioral Health, and newly arrived Bhutanese, Burmese, and Nepalese residents, and many of whom are now citizens. It took up a whole city block. You see it when you ride the bus. And the artist isn't contacted. The funds that the city put through there, you know, we have a percent for art program. We should really have a percent for redevelopment. When art goes away, some things do have to go, right? But it doesn't mean that we can't reinvest. We have to. It's a priority. If we don't do it now, we'll lose our history. When it comes to inventory, you know, we run Monument Lab, and there's a lot of collaborators here. Karen, of course, is one of the artists. Caitlin and Shira and a few other people here. Maya, I see you as well. We spoke to 250,000 people out in city parks and public squares in the city. We asked them what they thought an appropriate monument for the city would be, and 5,000 people left what they thought. It mapped across the city, spoke to people who could barely walk, either because they were young or they were elders. And it's astonishing to see, and this notion that the history is hidden, that it's untold, was disproven by this data set. Because actually, people know it, right? Mm-hmm. They know it. It's on their block, it's on their street, it's in their neighborhood. And so just this narrative, like the information itself, will help us. I agree with that. But it's also what our value system is with the information. Because the information's there. Mm-hmm. House museums, historic associations, you could find it in bronze and marble. That's a small sliver of the city's history. It's a lot of times living with community organizations and stewards who are already practicing it. So they're doing their designation. It just isn't rising to the level of the municipal.
It makes me think of the flip side with the Stenton House. And I did a project in Stenton Park, and it was amazing to me that I spent a lot of time in the park before I could come up with an idea. It just didn't make sense that I'm not from that neighborhood, I'm in the next neighborhood over. But everyone said they knew that Stenton House existed and was important, but most people had not been inside. Mm-hmm. And I was going to propose, when I was speaking to the curator, I was like, my proposal is just going to be get rid of that chain link fence and put like a nice fence. And she's like, Karen, you won't get the proposal. You won't get the commission if you do that. But I said, that's the thing we need first. You don't need a monument. We do need it. And I want the Dinah Commission. I do want that commission. But I thought, what would it signal that this place that is obviously being preserved, it's important, it's actually open to the community? And now it turns out they're going to, next year, there's going to be a first phase where they're going to have like one wall that's going to be like a nice gate. But I thought, what does that mean that you're in a neighborhood and those folks have not stepped foot in? They might go to the Halloween or Easter egg hunt or whatever, but they don't feel like that's their house and that's their history and that has nothing to do with them. So I was thinking about that on the other side of, they know it's important, but for certain people. You know, it's for certain people.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the definition of what is historic, what is worth preserving on some level is shifting mm-hmm. as people understand more about what resonates with individuals in the city. But what is there ways for the city to kind of solve this problem, to solve this disconnect? You know, like, so with Monument Lab, actually, is sort of interesting. Just last week, we reported on this monument that's coming back, a monument to the indigenous history at Penn Treaty Park that's coming back, looking for a permanent home for what was a temporary installation. And it seemed like some of the problems around finding a permanent home for that was that the indigenous community in the city wasn't necessarily empowered, didn't necessarily have like the institutional power. That was my reading, and I don't know if that's a correct reading of it. But I wonder if you could just sort of reflect on some of the learnings about the eventual futures for these monuments.
Yeah, there's a group to recognize Indigenous 215 that's, at least in my understanding, come into more formation since that project was envisioned. That was by a First Nations artist from Canada, Dwayne Linklater, who had spent a lot of time in Philadelphia looking for the Chief Tamanan statue and was looking all around and kept tripping over William Penn history and then found kind of right there on the entryway to 95 this statue that was dedicated by the city. And so for his project, he wanted to put the words in response to the treaty in neon lights at Penn Treaty Park, that the treaty should last as long as the creeks and rivers flow and the sun, moon, and stars endure, as a bittersweet take. Mm-hmm. I think what I see is that there are municipal processes that you go through if you have the time, the money, and the power to do it. And we've seen some important outcomes to that. The city's dedication of the first sculpture to a single person of color on public land, Octavius Caddo, was in 2017. If you do not have the time, the money, and the power and the resources, you gather around a monument that exists, you find another way through. In the case of Penn Treaty Park, in addition to Indigenous organizers, the Penn Treaty Museum, which is a self-started organization by John Connors, who's been a longtime steward of the park, have been aware of the inequities of representation there, and they've been trying to fill that gap. So, I mean, from my standpoint, because we work with the city, but we're not of the city, we know that we both have to have a long view of history and an urgent one. And when we've asked this question to the public, we also ask it to artists. And I have to say, one of these kind of questions of like, well, what do we do? What's our solution? Is ask artists. They're already doing that work. I brought up that notion of the building boom and this kind of crisis, and a lot of the new housing stock that goes up is missing some really important parts, right? The stoop. So Caitlin Pomerantz took note of that, and in Washington Square Park in 2017, replaced several benches with historic stoops from homes that had been demolished in the last 6 months, and brick from other buildings that were historic, right? And researched what this was, researched the materials, worked with the masonry union. And you know what people did before the cement was dry. They set up shop on those stoops. And it was like a ghost block. So I think one of these kind of outcomes is asking an artist. Their ears are to the ground earlier. They're sensing that long arc and the short term. And artists at the table, not at the end for ornamentation, not to check off a box, but really at a point where we need transformation. Trust artists, we will benefit.
So now I want to flip to you, Ori. As a developer who's building things constantly in the city, and as someone who's come under criticism for not preserving particular buildings, I want to ask two different questions. One is, you know, you preserved, I think, recently the Smith School, right? And that's a project that has gotten a lot of positive feedback in the community. It's an adaptive reuse of a historic school building, and you use the federal historic tax credits there for that. But developers across the board say that there's not enough incentives locally or federally to make more projects like that happen. So I'd be interested to hear from you about your experience using that, and what kind of incentive do you think would work in the city? And then secondly, I'd like you to respond to Paul. And do you see a role for working with artists as you're in the way that you work in communities when you're doing a project that has particular cultural conflict embedded into it?
Sure. So the Walter Smith School, by the way, has been aggressively opposed in the community, not supported. The fact that we're saving the historic architectural fabric falls by the wayside because there's an element that very much wants that to remain a school. So we did utilize federal tax credits there. If I knew then what I know today, we still would have saved the building, for sure. An adaptive reuse of that property made a lot of sense, but we would have never utilized the historic tax credits. The additional cost and not having fenestrations, the facade, things of that nature, far exceeded any benefit that we're going to get from historic tax credits. But again, it's a perfect example of a building that lends itself well to adaptive reuse. The building was built like a tank. No one that looked at it, myself included, ever considered the idea of demolishing it. I have no idea if it's even designated or not, because it lent itself well to being maintained as a building. The question was about bringing artists into an early conversation. Developers were eager to get things built, and we want our developments to fit into the fabric and to make sense. Many times the zoning and building code of our city flies in the face of what all of us would call good architecture and attractive use. So we haven't specifically brought in artists, but landscape designers, very capable architects, etc. And we go through a design by consensus process and a process with the city that doesn't always make a lot of sense. So we'd love to match stoop heights and window heights and use more traditional brick and limestone facades. But there's a lot of conflicts beyond that within the code that sometimes make that less obvious. The gas and electric meters that you see on the facades that ruin much of the streetscapes. The two-story setbacks in my neighborhood in Point Breeze that look atrocious, that were designed to try to maintain the cornice line, but do a disastrous job of doing that. And so it's not always as simple as the developer's just not aware of it, and had they brought somebody that was intelligent or aware into the process, it would have had a different outcome. We're driven by a lot of different elements.
Well, but I think bringing artists, I wasn't talking in that sense about architects or landscape designers. I was thinking about, for instance, like with a project like I don't, you're not working at the Baptist church, but 19th Street Baptist is a great example of that. This is a Frank Furness designed church that now the city just denied a demolition permit from it. Some people want it to be preserved. The church is sort of just needs to move on, I think, and is trying to get money for the property. They can't afford to do much. So I think it's probably likely that eventually that building will come down. If you were going to build that, would that be an opportunity to bring in artists that could work with the community to think about how to memorialize the community that was there at some point?
So I don't know. I mean, that building, I hope it gets saved. Without question, that's going to require the church to be willing to give it away for a nominal fee. They want $1 million+, and in that equation, it gets demolished. But it would ultimately get built as townhomes, so I perhaps pass the question back on. How do you take what would be 8 or 9 or 10 townhomes and provide some type of public work or something else that provide, you know, a hint or a nod to what was there before?
May I follow up with Ori? Speaking of art, the Royal Theater, which was first listed in the Green Book in 1938, the murals, what's going to happen to the murals that were on the facade?
So all of the murals that were on the, excuse me, the large murals on the first floor have all been saved. We expect many, if not most of them, to be incorporated into the ground floor. Future tenant of the space, which we...
On the interior?
Yes. Yes. The upstairs murals weren't particularly significant. I don't think anyone is looking for those. But we do currently have all of them. We always hope that they be repurposed. We took great care to have them removed. And we not only wanted those murals to be preserved in a way that would be public and obvious to those in the future, but we actively curated a commercial tenant that we believe would very much complement the history of that property. So
The commercial tenant is Rex?
Yes.
Do you have any idea what their plans are?
I do.
Okay, what are they?
So I'll only speak to what's public and the plans that I've seen. They're looking, it's a restaurant that's 2 doors down, and it's one that has a lot of gluten-free options, by the way. I go there regularly. But more importantly, they were very aware of the jazz history of that site, and they have a stage there. They're going to have live music. I don't believe every night. It's still a restaurant. Heather, who's the manager hiding there, could speak more credibly. But without question, they were aware of it. We were aware of it. They were by no means the party that was paying the most, but it was the story that was most reflective of what we wanted to see as the future anchor of South Street West.
Okay.
So we're going to have live music, and we're going to have a lot of things. I shouldn't say we. They are going to have live music. We're providing space, and I'm excited for all that's going to come.
Yeah, sure.
So I think that the intent to preserve, especially those murals, is important, and we should mark that. Also, just though, do want to say that the word public is a really tricky one, because it moves from not just public view, public space when one is not a resident or a consumer, but it's part of the public assets paid for by public dollars originally in the city. Mm-hmm. And it's not just on you to fix that, but it's actually on all of us to talk about it. I think in that question about why we bring in artists and what they can do, one of the things that artists do is bring a level of transparency to the issue, because it's not necessarily about a fiscal year return. It's not about the rush to figure out yes, no. It's actually figuring out what's at the bottom of this. What is the pulse of this? Who is benefiting? Who is pushed out? What is the reinvention? And it's not always to just hold on to this idea of the past that's like static or frozen, but it's really to work the present. And so you have artists who do that in all different kind of ways. I think one of the challenges that I personally have is that it seems like townhomes, condos, and commercial development are, for the most part, the answer. And perhaps that's a financial reality, but in my line of work, it feels like that is prioritizing just profit over other things that a community might need. So to me, why you have an artist is, and maybe this is something that at scale can really be accomplished powerfully. Not every property you said you're going to develop. Some you'll figure out what to do. Some it's not fiscally wise. But it's not just about the artist as a sole representative. It's that idea that this is public and it affects public audiences, public goods, public will.
And so I don't know if you're pointing at me or me as just an average citizen in the city, but for the Royal Theater, for example, there were decades of opportunity to turn that into something that would have been far greater than what it is. I'm thrilled with what we were able to salvage and the facade and the use and all of that, but 30 and 40 years of neglect and abandonment, not just by the developer, but by the community organizations and neighbors. And then the developer comes in at the end here, and yes, there will always be the party that gets the vitriol associated with demolition. But I don't believe the answer in any facet is bring an artist, right? Because we all can appreciate what could have been of that space. There's no one that looks at what is there today and what was there 5, 10, 30 years ago and says this should not be a theater. We'd love for it to be. But it's not the lacking of ideas, it's the lacking of resources and process to create the vision that you and I and most of this audience here would likely share.
Well, I think probably there are a lot of different visions for the Royal Theater and for many of these other sites, and they mean different things to all of us, right? We have a very few minutes left. So, I mean, I guess I want to ask one quick final question that I want each of you to answer, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. And then, I hope that our questions, we can be quick in what we ask because we're, again, have a limited amount of time. So the final question, I guess, is what is each of you one ask of City Hall to make your respective jobs easier and more productive towards your vision for preservation?
We're in the 60th year of Percent for Art, which is something that was pioneered here in Philadelphia. Many cities utilize it. 1% of a budget for public building goes toward art. It's why we have the nation's one of the nation's leading public art collections. And so we should have a percent for redevelopment that takes 1% of a budget of a building that's displacing an artwork that would either bring back the artwork in another form, prioritize a new artwork, or work on some kind of process that moves artwork as well as that property. So I would love to see that it would have profound impact and like the Percent for Art program would be a model for the rest of the country.
I mean, I don't have a specific, that's really good. For me, it would be more, I mean, I go back to James Baldwin all the time. I would ask that they ask the question the answer hides every time. You think you have the answer? No, what's the question underneath that? And that's going to lead to these other things.
If every taxpayer in Philadelphia contributed $10 a year, there would be enough money to preserve every building that we'd like to preserve, right? It's not huge dollars here. The problem is that City Hall has not introduced any legislation to protect any property. Right, so the budget isn't there, but my ask to City Hall would be to raise taxes exactly $10 for every resident. And then developers would have a real opportunity to say, hey, there's a pot of money here to contribute to this building. And you'd see a lot more preservation occurring. So that's my simple ask.
My ask as a lifelong activist would be for City Hall to get real. Tomorrow marks the day that Frank Rizzo was hatched. The city has spent untold thousands of dollars repairing and securing that hunk of junk that no one wants. Meanwhile, a national historic landmark, one of only 67 in the city, and national historic landmark is in caps. That's the highest designation for an historic property. City Hall is one, the Academy of Music, and the John Coltrane House. While taxpayers' money is being used to repair and secure that hunk of junk at City Hall, visitors come here to go to John Coltrane House. They see the condition it's in, and they say, well, you know what they say. So the city should get real about its priorities. The money is there. It's how it's being spent.
Okay. Well, that kind of closes us out. And tomorrow's Frank Rizzo's birthday. I just learned something new. So we're going to, we have, I think, 15 minutes for Q&A here. And Elizabeth Estrada, our audience engagement editor, is going to pass around the microphone.
Okay, so I see one over here.
Have our first question.
All right, can you stand up and give us your name?
Yes, my name is Marilyn Kai Jewett. I'm one of the two surviving founders of the John Coltrane Cultural Society, who we were the ones who decided to make this a historic site. Had nothing to do with any organization or the city. And we resent you and anybody else saying that they want the city to come take over private property. Cousin Mary designated who she sold that to. One of the family members is right here. You have no right to put an article in the newspaper, in the white press, about a black site that's for us. It's for the entire city. However, we resent that. It's not supported by the Coltrane family. It's not supported by the jazz organizations in the city or the jazz community. We're not going to let you or anyone else have the city come in. And it was despicable that you put all the L&I violations that they had, they owe this much property taxes. Why would you do that as a black woman? You're putting it out there. You've got all kind of developers, white developers, calling this family, trying to get their property. I don't know who you're talking to, but the ancestors of the Coltrane family, I talked to them. The ancestors from our organization, there's only two of us left. So four of them are gone. Five of them are gone now. They're ancestors. They are not going to let you or anyone else come in and have the city come in and take that property. That's private property that's owned by the Gadsden family. That's who Cousin Mary wanted to have it. You're trying to open the door for the white developers to come in there and take it. We're not having it. So I'm putting you on notice now. It's not happening. So the best thing you could do is step away and find somebody else's property to mess with, because you're not getting that one.
Marilyn, as I told you via email, thanks for sharing. I'm a lifelong activist. I don't have to ask for permission. Marilyn, let me finish that. The house has been in a deteriorating condition for years. There is concern about not just the condition of the house, but the John Coltrane house, but the adjacent properties are in poor condition. So the city, all the ask of the city is to go in there and do what L&I does to make sure that the house is structural, is stable. Because without that, okay, I'll just leave it at that. Again, thanks for sharing, Marilyn.
Okay. All right.
Marilyn, thanks
Thank
for sharing.
You. We're gonna
I told
move
you, have
to
a good day.
Question.
Now, have a good evening.
We're not having it.
Thank you.
Take that.
Oh, okay. Hi, I'm Suzanne Cloud. I'm founding director of JazzBridge, and I'm current project director of the Jazz Legacy Project. And there were some inaccuracies here by the Gadsden family saying that none of the jazz organizations in the city support the efforts to rehabilitate the Coltrane House. That is absolutely not true.
You know what?
We are all worried about it.
I'm sorry. We're going to shift away.
Well, my question, I do have a question of the panel. What do you do? What does the city do or interested parties do when you have people that are where a historical monument or historical home is falling down and no one can help preserve it because you have problems dealing with the people who own it? And then the people who want to see it preserved.
May I answer that? Because I was involved with the Robert Purvis House at Mount Vernon in 16th. Robert Purvis was widely viewed as the father of the Underground Railroad. That house had been owned by the same owner since the 1970s. I think he bought in 77. So for over 30 years, the house is in Spring Garden. Over that time, Spring Garden is gentrified. So now he's seeing dollar signs. He wants to demolish the house. The house is on the local register, so it was protected. least marginally protected from demolition. And so finally, after years of pursuing a strategy of demolition by neglect, he had gone so far as to open the windows when the hurricane came through, hoping that the winds would blow it away. That house is now under conservatorship and being preserved.
Did you want to respond to that? All right, another question over here. Excuse me, can I just go through? Can you stand for me?
Hi. My name is Mignon Verdell. Just have a quick question. I was thinking about some of the earlier conversation around, A, what City Hall can do to kind of help some of these issues. The fact that it was mentioned that there is data that exists about people knowing history in their neighborhoods. There was a mention also of some sort of like list of things so that people could refer to that. So I was thinking about having attended RCO meetings where developers come and get like attacked for wanting to do projects. And a lot of times this history that everyone thinks isn't there does come out. People in the neighborhood stand up and they're saying, you know, I knew someone who lived there, or this used to be this or that. And it seems like the developers caught off guard, a lot of other people there weren't aware of it. So how can these things, I guess when you think about an ask of City Hall and maybe the role of RCOs in collecting this data or providing it, or it being provided by the city to people to empower themselves to maybe like designate something as a public space, for example. I guess the question generally is how can those things come together? Because clearly the data is there, but from a zoning perspective, it seems like it's not, people feel disempowered and like caught off guard.
Thank you for your question. There's a lot of trauma in housing. There's a lot of trauma in redevelopment. And we should actually just expect that's part of every process, right? And figure out, I'm speaking not on behalf of the city, but on behalf of a creative community that really thinks about process and time and relationships. And so if we, rather than going in assuming that things are neutral and things are universal, let's actually go in with a perspective about present-day development that brings the layers of redlining, of segregation, of displacement into every conversation. It is there, right? The information is there, but the information as a priority and as a priority about the process, and also being open to the idea that the information is there, well, there's a lot more layers to it. Can that be a back and forth process? I think part of it is there are tough timelines, right? And if it's a political timeline, we're worried about councilmanic elections and mayoral elections, but the traumas of housing and the traumas of history exist beyond that. So we need more capacity to build it into the process and assume it will be there. And what do we do with it?
Hi. I'm very encouraged to hear you guys come today and all these ideas being presented. I really think it's like a really cool thing to have these discussions. My question is for the artist developer, I guess. It's sort of more related to the artist. So in my experience, I know that, you know, there are different people with different opinions and visions and stuff. And so there's like, quote unquote, like socially conscious artists, and then those that are maybe not as much. Same for developers. And so an example that I have in my neighborhood that's rapidly gentrifying is that there was like a mural, and it was like deteriorating, and so then a new mural was put up in place of it, and then the people who had were involved in that had said they had consulted community groups about that, but I attended the RCO meeting, I attended some of the community meetings in the neighborhood, and I never heard a peep about that. I just, all of a sudden, one day I saw that it was changed.
Which mural or which neighborhood are you in?
West Poplar, Calla Hill, West Poplar. So this is near 12th and Spring Garden. So my question is, as a normal resident in the city, what can we do, or how do we have conversations with those that are less socially conscious, whether they be artists, developers, or anybody else?
Thank you for your question. There are a lot of stakes in this, and they're differing stakes, and there's not an easy answer. But I would say that in my experience, being on a number of panels in this city and in other cities about community engagement, there's an approach in which you are hungry to hear what people have to say, or you actually have information you need to learn. And then there's another process, and I'm bifurcating this for simplicity, there's a lot in between, but let's say there's another process that community engagement is a check. Well, we had the meeting and no one showed up, right? I think in those moments, if I'm on a call with a monument designer or whether it's municipal or more of a private commission, I'll say, well, what do you want to know? What do you want to learn? If you assume that this cultural asset has no value unless people show up to planning meetings and charrettes and things that are very well trafficked perhaps for our design community, but sometimes people attend, but sometimes people have work or they have childcare, they have other stuff going on. So assume that there's value, assume that there's a story, and find that information and make that part of your process.
And also with that is the time. Spend time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Stenton House project, there are community meetings from December to June. There's like 7-month commitment. And even my presentation, I said, wait, I have to give it twice? It's like, yeah, because some people can't attend. We want to have as many people's voices. So to me, it's the time and the commitment.
That's a courtesy. That, you know, like, I was there when you were giving that presentation. And it's not a given in the field of art that mm-hmm. always the artists are present. Mm-hmm. And to be there in face-to-face, you're not mm-hmm. delivering art from mm-hmm. afar, and they are not doing community engagement to check off a box.
Yeah, the community engagement was real. It felt, and you felt it, because those people showed up for the presentations. If it was just that checkbox, it would have just been the folks you expect, the historical people, the Stenton House folks. It was, people were there, mm-hmm. you know, the time.
So I think we have room for time for one more question. I think Elizabeth has that. Yep.
Jack Butler. Thank you all for coming. Interesting stuff. Anyway, I had to laugh inside when one of you had said something about going to City Hall to see if we could, they could suggest ways to make something easier. Really now. This is probably, Ori probably is probably the best to address this. We have a tradition in City Council called Councilman Prerogative. And with all of your talking about, you know, what each of you can do, what each of you can contribute to preservation versus development, gentrification, ultimately, with some projects, the district council person has a lot to say about whether something can be done. In Point Breeze, I'm not going to mention a name, or you'll know exactly who I'm talking about, is that the city council person did not want any new development to have bay windows or balconies, because that would be like too culturally, you know, against what was in the neighborhood before. To be concerned with something like that is ridiculous when you're talking about trying to redevelop a neighborhood. But I want to know how much councilmanic prerogative, which I think can be potentially very harmful in certain neighborhoods of the city, how much that really is affecting the ability of developers and preservationists to get things done.
So, thank you for your question. As it relates to preserving historic sites or the historic fabric, I don't actually think that it plays at least a direct or linear role in preservation. What it does is it creates a process that limits a community's opportunity to showcase and share the priorities that the neighborhood has. Right, not a direct parallel for historic preservation, but planning. The Planning Commission in the City of Philadelphia, the Planning Commission is filled with incredibly bright people, spent not months but years designing Philadelphia's 2035 plan of what we'd like to see in every part of town, where we want our industry, our homes, our commercial businesses, how we want them to look, what direction we want our streets to go, where we want public medians and public spaces. It was a collaborative effort that wasn't attended by dozens. It was attended by hundreds and hundreds of people, meeting after meeting after meeting. And that was supposed to be the impetus for our district council members to introduce the 2035 plan. In some neighborhoods, that happened. In others, like at Point Breeze, it didn't. So I don't know that the councilman hates new construction. Look, I ran against him, and he and I are never going to share Shabbat dinner together. What he likes is this environment where, regardless of the project, regardless of the plan, regardless of the proposal, it's hand-to-hand combat. It's vitriolic. And so every time there's an opportunity to have a real conversation, whether it's broader planning or whether it's preserving something, it gets lost, right? Because there isn't a single development that's buildable in that neighborhood as a matter of right. So how does, if I could just really, I'll shut up.
I mean, I just want to interject. We've done a lot of reporting on this issue, so I know Councilman Johnson's talking point here, and what he would say in response to it is that why he doesn't, you know, amend the zoning maps the way other council people have done is that he believes in community engagement, and he wants to provide an opportunity for the community to come out to these meetings. I'm not saying I believe that this is necessarily what happens in every case, but I think when we're talking about council manic prerogative and when we're talking about so many of these processes, I think it's really important to just acknowledge, for all of us to acknowledge, that these are all proxies for power. And that all of these powers and all of these things come down to who is the gatekeeper. And councilmanic prerogative is one way that elected representatives are able to hold on to some amount of gatekeeping power over their community. And whether you disagree with that or not, or whatever you think about this, I think we can't like divorce the question of power from this conversation and who people feel as if they're representing and in some cases are representing. So,
I love you for that answer. So sorry for interrupting. Just to give two facts on priorities. I'm going to get in trouble. Just get very brief.
I'm going to actually, I don't want to.
I wasn't saying, you know, I didn't want to suggest that any council person was trying to prevent development. I mentioned something about that.
Sure, no, I didn't. Yeah. But just very quickly, and I'll shut up and I'll turn off my microphone. The city of Philadelphia spends $26 million a year preserving vacant land, and not the type of vacant land that Faye would love to have as a placemaking space, just random, abandoned, blighted lots. The city of Philadelphia spends $0 preserving historic sites. Zero. And that's year after year after year, $26 million a year. So I'll let you sleep on that while I turn off my microphone.
And we're going to turn to Paul now, and then we're going to move over into the other room for some cocktails where this, well, wine and beer, excuse me, where this conversation can continue and some appetizers.
Yeah. So when it comes to this question of power, something that in working in and out of municipal offices for, you know, the better part of the last decade, I leave with a question of who runs the city. And I do two things with that. One, I get my popcorn out because it's fascinating to see. It plays out street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood, and I don't have one opinion on councilmanic prerogative or, you know, the power of redevelopment or industry or artists or activists. It plays out every day. There's not one set way it works. That's the beauty and complexity of our city. So other than the popcorn, you got to go show up. And I've sat with city council people, I sat with their aides, their assistants, the art office, the shared prosperity office, you name it. And what City Hall is full of people trying to figure out their way. Are there broken systems? Yeah. But whose broken systems are those? They're ours. The poet Audre Lorde said that the rumor that we can't fight City Hall was created by City Hall. City Hall is ours, so while we watch things play out and appreciate that long arc, we got to show up. It's us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point to leave on. I want to, before we move to the other room, I just want to say a special thank you for everyone who supports WHYY, all of you for coming here regardless, and for our staff, in particular Elizabeth Estrada, our audience engagement editor, who organized this event tonight. And I'm not sure if Jake is in the room, but he has, you know, kept us informed and very busy reporting on preservation these past years. So I'll give him a shout out. It's also his birthday, so. All right, and we are adjourned.